Excellent. Thank you. Happy. Now you can hear me. Great. Well, it's a pleasure to be here this year again to the for the Linux conference, and I would like to thank the organizing team for inviting me, and also for putting up this show, which is great. And I just would like to talk a little bit about things that interest me in computers, music, and free software, and might interest you as well. Okay, so let's start. Okay, good. The Linux Revolution is a remarkable achievement of the free software movement. In about 10 years, it swept across the Unix and populated machines everywhere in the world. From our mobile phones to PDAs to big irons and clusters, we see the Linux kernel powering computers. In its wake, we see the spread of knowledge and information enabled by the concept of free software. As we move from one Linux system to another, not only life is made easier by the availability of the same or very similar tools, but more importantly, these are systems we can learn more about because nothing is hidden in it. In other words, there's no holding us back because of proprietary issues. Linux, however, is but a component of the great jigsaw that makes up the big free software picture. Firstly, as Richard Stallman reminds us, what we call Linux is actually the GNU Linux operating system. Funnily enough, despite being the most visible part of the system, GNU software is often not given its due, despite being the most visible part of the system. A remarkable achievement on its own as a collection of software that has on the whole replaced what we know as Unix. The GNU project is present almost everywhere you look, and far beyond Linux too. My first encounter with GNU was using a version of Emacs called Micro Emacs in an Atari ST machine. In addition to GNU Linux, a number of other free software, free operating systems exist, such as BST. From GNU project itself, there is the exciting project of the Herd kernel, which when it finally arrives, will probably send a chill down most developers and hackers' spines. All of these systems give good choice to anyone looking to use free software, at perhaps the price of having to learn something about it before actually using it. Beyond this, there's a wealth of free and open source software for other non-free operating systems. A walk through SourceForge demonstrates how just much the concept has developed. Overall, using free software is starting to become a part of the lives of many people. Hopefully, as we'll see in the course of this talk, it will take over the world. Music systems developers have historically pledged allegiance to the idea of open source, if not free software. Computer music and free software are forever joined at the hip. The development of the music family of music programming languages, perhaps the most important genealogy of computer music programs, has effectively been free software, probably even before the concept was ever originated. It is worth for a while tracing the development of this software to demonstrate how it actually benefited from the concept of free software. The music and family of software originated at the Bell Telephone Laboratories from the work of Max Matthews, who wrote Music 1 in 1957 and Music 2 in 1958. These programs had been written for the IBM 704, a relatively primitive machine, and were themselves very basic, producing direct synthesis triangle wave signals. They nevertheless were the first programs to generate digital audio as we know it today. Samples were dumped to a magnetic tape that could be put through a primitive digital to analog converter, and the sound was recorded onto analog tape for further performances. In fact, an earlier attempt actually happened in Australia, of all places, with the Schirach computer, which had a digitally controlled hooter that was programmed to play melodies. But this was perhaps the first digitally controlled sound device, but not digital audio as we know it. The real breakthrough came with Music Tree in 1960 for the IBM 7094. This program introduced many of the programming concepts we see in today's computer music languages. One is the unit generator, for instance, which is the synthesis building block of music programming languages. The table lookup oscillator, which is the workhorse of digital synthesis. Music Tree paved the way for the development of computer music and was a formidable achievement. A number of composers and researchers were attracted by Matthew's ideas and joined in the work. Then you have Tenney, Howe, Winnan, and Randall, among others. In 1962, Music 4 was created, providing the basic model for the whole series of derivatives. Written mostly in assembly for the IBM 7094, this was then passed on from Bell Labs to Princeton University, where a new version, 4B, was created for the same computer model. Other centers became interested in software, so Fortran-coded versions appeared, Music 4F and Music 4BF, as you can see there. It is unclear as to what degree of all of these programs were free software, but at least their source code seemed to be open, as they were distributed among a number of research centers and spawned a whole series of variations and a family tree of software. Now, these are the computers that you can see these programs run. So they fill the whole room, more than one room, probably. I'll play a little bit of music from, yeah. Now, a lot of many of you will already know this. Now, this first one, many of you already know, I'll just mention, just say what it was. It was actually done with the IBM 7094. And it's music for accompaniment to vocoder-based digital voice synthesis. Many of you would know, this is actually was the origin of a famous scene in the 2001 film, of the book and then the film. So where the computer sings this when he's dying. Okay, now direct descendants from these programs will include, well, from Music 4, then you have a number of them. You have Music 4B and 4BF. Then you have, in Stanford University, you have Music 6, Music 10. Then Bell Labs created Music 5, from which customized versions were developed and used in many other places around the world. In fact, this Music 5 was used throughout the 70s and early 80s, actually, at ERCAM and other places. Then you have, at MIT, you have Music 360, Music 11, which then eventually led into C-Sound. And Music 5 also was the basis for C-Music at San Diego. So from this family tree, we have also indirect descendants on the form of widely used systems such as RTC Mix, CLM, and adopted children such as Pure Date and Super Collider. None of this development would have happened if proprietary constraints had been put in this work from the beginning. Generations of computer music researchers and composers have learned from the availability of this software in binary and source code forms, developing their skills, using and improving them. It is interesting that Although intrinsically free, most of these software systems were built on top of proprietary systems until the availability of free operating systems, effectively with Linux and GNU software. In the early 90s, many of these big computer music packages were available as source code for FTP download, sometimes covered by confusing licenses, such as C-Sound and the MIT license. More about this later. Sometimes without any license whatsoever. As a postgraduate student at the University of Nottingham in 1993, I had heard of these and was willing to spend some of my spare time doing something with them. I managed to get from cecilia.media.mit.edu the source code for C-Sound, which after some makefile fiddling, I built on a MIPS machine running AT&T Unix. The trouble was the machine did not have any means of playing audio. In fact, I didn't know, not even know where it was located physically. My use of C-Sound was restricted to reading the printed out messages and checking for clipping errors, etc., and then running the same thing, the same C-Sound code on a much, much slower Atari ST machine. Then I got access to some workstations with audio, so I rebuilt C-Sound on them and was able to use it there. With this success, then, I tried to do the same with CMix and Common Music with mixed results. The thing is that a lot was learned in the process. And as a result of this package being available as free software, I was able to learn a lot, and many people did the same as well. That's the IBM 360 where the Music 360 was running. And then this is the PDP-11. That was a breakthrough, actually, because it's an affordable mini computer. And Music 11 was running on this. And this was actually the system that was used in many places throughout the sort of late 70s and 80s, which is a great little system. Okay, we'll move on. An interesting initiative that perhaps did not qualify as free. An interesting initiative that perhaps did not qualify as free or open source software, although these terms were not in current use then, and perhaps will never describe it very well, was seen in the early days of the Composer's Desktop project. Developed in a number of universities and in the UK, CDP tried to put together an affordable system for computer music. In the early 90s, most of the source code was available for its users to adapt, modify, and experiment with. The whole principle of cooperative for composers developing for an affordable platform was very reminiscent of what goes on in much larger scale within the Linux community now. The affordable platform in around 1990 was the Atari ST. One of its attractions was that it had a built-in MIDI interface. The CDP group was, however, thinking much beyond MIDI, and in fact, the fact that the Atari had MIDI became of little importance in the system. The major problem was how to get audio in and out of the machine. And one of the more electronics-minded members, Dave Mullen, developed the so-called Sound Streamer, which was an in-between bit of hardware that connected the Atari games port to a Sony PCM encoder decoder. The Sony PCM was actually designed for use with Betamax machines for digital audio recording, and it was, in fact, one of the first such commercial systems. So in terms of hardware, the system was capable of playing and recording audio, as well as writing and reading to Betamax tapes. With a grant from the Gulbenkian Foundation and support from some UK university, software was written and ported to the system. Now, the software included C Music, C Sound, the Groucho manipulation package, a graphical additive synthesis program, a graphical desktop, a command line interpreter, and developers' tools such as Emacs and Make. Another important bit of the system was the sound filing system, which was complete with an API. And this enabled large files to be written to disk, something that the Atari operating system did not provide. In later years, the system moved out to a PC Windows platform and became more proprietary. losing its initial cooperative status. I have myself benefited enormously from using the CDP platform. It was quite irritating in the beginning to spend 3 days for a particular processing run to finish and then see some mistakes in it. But it was a great educational experience. Well, in fact, as CSound was concerned, I had Unix testing workaround mentioned, so things were not too bad. Now, since music departments generally could not afford expensive Unix machines with audio hardware, the Atari CDP box was a way into computer music for people like me. Having bits of development software, source code, and time to look into these things was a good didactic combination. This account of the early days of CDP perhaps demonstrates how free software not only benefits the community of users, but also the software itself. The larger its user base and developer community, the more it will thrive in the software pool. Another good illustration of this principle is CSound. Although for many years based on 70s code design concepts and using an assembly-like orchestra language, it grew to become one of the most used music programming languages. This was largely due to its availability, perhaps as much to do as with the existence of documentation, its performance, and the fact that it was extendable. CSound was one of the first music software to become fully available for FTP download when it was released in 1986. As discussed above, many individuals around the world, myself included, picked it up to mess around with it. Thanks largely to John Fitch's work on organizing the source code into the canonical CSound, the software became the largest system around in terms of its unit generator collection and, of course, its UGENs and etc. This was the effort of a large development community, which is evident when we look at the credit list with over 30 names on it. As with this type of effort, people have come and gone, and the development has occurred in bursts and splits. A number of flavors of CSound were spawned, somewhat repeating the fate of the music and family tree. Some of these survived, some died. But development nevertheless went forward and things got changed and improved as needed. I would just like to quote now Richard Dobson, who said in 1999 something very interesting about CSound and CMusic, comparing the fates of CSound and CMusic. He says, "I suppose one significant difference between CMusic and CSound, which might explain the relative lack of modern opcodes in the former, is that while CMusic has largely remained the property and product of Richard Moore, CSound has reaped the benefit of a large, skillful, enthusiastic, and mostly unrestrained net-wide user and development group. This is partly thanks to the prodigious work of John Fitch, just about keeping everyone and everything coordinated, but partly also due to the fact that CSound is still essentially standard C, such that anybody can have a go, including myself, on just about any platform, including the Atari ST, without having to climb a fierce learning curve of object orientation, STL, multithreading, YAC, LEX, etc." Now, the licensing issue was a question that took a while to be solved. CSound was originally released under the MIT license, which, in the view of many people in the community, was problematic and confusing. CSound was then moved to GPL and immediately after moved again to the LGPL, which was seen as less restrictive. One of the major issues was the fact that many of us did not really understand the fuss about licenses. For some, like me, this was due to ignorance. And for others, like John Fitch, it was because they came from an era where the concept of free software did not exist. As he said to me, in those days, the question was not there. Everyone shared the software. In fact, when we managed to get the software to work, we were so happy that we wanted to give it to everybody. With CSound, it was not the case that the source code for the sound compiler was available, but also that CSound code itself was freely distributed. Catalogs of CSound instruments were around for people to use, learn, and modify, from Richard Boulanger's Toots to the famous Amsterdam catalog. A wealth of code was being made available for the community. All of these things were incredibly useful for people learning computer music, composition, signal processing, etc. For this community, such resources are often more important than C source code. That is also the case elsewhere. All the PG patches, SuperCollider code, etc. are fantastic resources available to any computer musician who wants to learn. This, in fact, brings us to a recent project that is agitating some parts of the free software community, the One Laptop Per Child project, known as OLPC. OLPC is a non-profit organization set up by MIT Media Lab staff to provide a $100 laptop as an educational resource for children in mostly developing countries. Although this is not restricted to them. So the countries that have joined in include China, India, Brazil, Egypt, Nigeria, Thailand, and Argentina. The specification for the laptop is almost finalized, and the software that will run in it will be all free software. The kernel will be the latest Linux, and Red Hat is one of the project sponsors, so it's likely that the distribution will be Fedora-like. It's not clear as to what exactly will be in the final system, but most likely a GNOME desktop, probably not a fully fledged one, will be there. The graphics toolkit will then most likely to be GTK, and the scripting language Python. In terms of hardware, the laptop will have a 500 megahertz AMD processor, 7-inch screen, 0.5 gigabyte of flash memory, no hard disk, 120 megabyte of RAM, wireless Ethernet, and of course audio input and output based on the AC97 design. The audio encoder decoder will be supplied by Analog Devices, and this is the AT1888. We in fact got involved in this because Barry Verkel has joined in to work on the music and audio part of the project, and then invited a group of us to look into it. The idea is that CSound 5 will be powering it as a sound server, doing the audio necessary tasks for synthesis, processing, and plumbing of audio. We will then be using scripted user interfaces for any music and audio software that will go into the system. This is where Python comes in and PyGTK for the graphics. Given the limited storage and memory space, it's likely that we will have a cut-down version of CSound 5, not the 1,000 plus opcodes, but something that that will have the basic things that we need. The idea for the software in the OLPC project is that it will be something that will enable constructionist learning, or learning by making things. So we want to provide tools for children to learn not only about music, but also about the sound universe around and beyond them. We want the laptop to become an instrument that can be played, used for messing with sound on its own, or in a group setting as an orchestra of laptops, interconnected by wireless networking. Since the idea of the project is to blanket cover areas with laptops so that every child has one, classes can become music groups where the music performance experience is shared. The interface to the system will be a crucial part. The important thing is to keep everything intuitive, but also open the door for further explorations. So it's likely that most users will not go to the level of CSound Orchestra, but some might. For this, some doors will be left open. In designing the graphic interface for different tools, it will be important to keep in mind that the target public will be of tremendous cultural and ethnic diversity. So it's important to provide culturally neutral interfaces, something that might prove quite hard. The networking part will also be an important component. The CSound server will need to be transparent, allowing for interconnection of machines at the control and audio levels. While the control side is mostly already present, in fact, I'll give some examples in my other talk, Scripting CSound. Sending audio signals will need some extra code and fine-tuning to the laptop hardware. This is actually a very exciting idea, which might move upwards from the OLPC project into other high-end Linux music performance systems. The OLPC is a very exciting initiative that places GNU, Linux, and free software at the forefront of the spread of technology. This has, in fact, created interesting backlash reactions from the non-free software world. Bill Gates described the $100 laptop as a gadget, but later seemed to announce similar plans of his own. The Intel company has announced in Brazil their model for a $400 laptop of similar specification to OLPC. It might appear strange that Intel has chosen, of all places, to announce it in Brazil, but not when we learn that that country is one of the most interested partners in the OLPC project. If the project comes to full fruition, we might have a 500 million or more machines in the world running Linux, something that the non-free software industry might find difficult to swallow. The point I made about users needing an intuitive interface to play with is a perennial issue of music software design. With free software, it is often said that developers do not do a good job in facilitating the use of their programs. While this might be true in many cases, it raises the question of whether computer music software should actually be easy to use. At this point, it would be interesting to insert a much-quoted anecdote by Richard Moore, who's the creator of C-Music. It goes like this. Computer music as a field has been likened to a building with a sign on it saying, "Best eats in town." Many people go into this building expecting to find an elegant restaurant with a parchment menu, formidable wine list, and pleasant, efficient, even charming service. What they find instead, to their surprise, is a shiny, enormous, extremely modern kitchen with abundant supplies of every kind of foodstuff in voluminous refrigerated storage. Indeed, the best eats in town are available here, but only to those willing to learn to cook. The trend in computer music today, in all fields, from composition to performance, seems to provide easy-to-use interfaces, be it in hardware, controllers, etc., or in software. When this is placed against the backgrounds of Western musical tradition and Western science and technology, where learning something, such as instrument or a discipline, is a slow and arduous task, we seem to find a contradictory situation here. A violin did not seem to undergo its development in order to make it easier to play. In fact, most likely the opposite occurred. Yet somehow, when faced with a computer music software, we want immediate results, even without knowing anything about what we're doing. We do not seem to care about learning a craft. We want controllers that do not require us to learn and practice them, instruments that can be played without any effort. We require this, and we have got most of it. Easy-to-use graphic sequencers and synthesizers with preset beat patterns and crystal-clear sound. We have it to the point on which it's sometimes impossible to make anything that does not sound good. But of course, what we have got is an amorphous mass of sameness. When we finally realize that microwave dinners are not what we want, cooking is what is required, and a good, well-stocked kitchen. Free software is the kitchen. Some of it comes with great recipes too, which might be learned. And it's a way ahead of proprietary software in this area, mainly because it does not really need pre-cooked wares to be able to stand out in an overcrowded marketplace. So most of the effort is placed at the right task for this, which is furnishing the kitchen. This simple realization is enough to persuade anyone who's serious about their craft, computer music, to look at what the free software community has to offer. The learning curve might be steeper, but it pays off in the long run. The journey is as important as reaching the destination. As we saw, free software is an open door. Regardless of it being or not being on top of a free operating system, or even cohabiting with other non-free programs. In fact, it opens doors for further experience with free software. Many users and developers, myself included, moved on to experiment with and use free operating systems as an extension of other encounters and experiences with free software in proprietary environments. We hope that future generations will have a closer and more immediate contact with free software, and perhaps the OLPC project might have a part to play with this. Development for Linux is important, but beyond it, there is a whole world of software, so it would be worthwhile extending this to say developing free software for as many platforms as you can is even more important. More free software means more open doors available for anyone wanting to get out, leading eventually to a bigger world beyond free software, free music, free art, free learning, free ideas. Thank you very much.
Take some questions?
Yes. Frank says we have some minutes, a few minutes for questions, if you have any.
So, questions from the audience. As usual, if you ask anything, please first state your name and country you're from, and then go ahead. Volunteers? Okay, then thank you, Victor.
Okay.
Then we'll be going on at, we started late, so we continue late. We continue at 12:15 with Franz Adriansen on the Aliki software project. See you then.
It's a new thing that has happened in the past few months.
Frank,
yes?
For the screen, is it 768 by 1000 or is it 1000 by 1200?
1024 by 768.
Okay.
Yeah. 43.
Yeah.
Cool. Just
put it in the chat.
That's because that's the only option.
Okay.